Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient, and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Following the Guardian's revelation of the biggest domestic spying operation in American history, we ask, what does it mean for state security and trust in government? How could this happen under the noses of the most data-conscious private technology companies on the planet? And what makes a man risk everything to blow the whistle on his own government? Also this week, teaching to the test. Michael Gove unveils a revamped GCSE curriculum for England that cuts out coursework and makes the final exams the be-all and end-all. A welcome return to academic rigour, or an untested, nostalgia-tinged vanity project? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, our data editor, James Ball, and our political columnist, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, before last week's revelations by The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald, the nature of America's spying domestic operations were presumed to be legally warranted, specifically targeted, and relatively rare. We now know the truth, which is rather different. But unlike the great spymaster in the sky, I imagine many of us are probably already losing track of the details. James, I wonder if you could remind us of roughly what we learnt and when.
I think it's quite important to look at. There were a string of quite different revelations through the week. The initial document was quite US-focused and revealed essentially a program of court orders which involved Verizon at the time, one of the US sort of mobile companies, and it was essentially ordering them to pass over all of the details of their customers' call records. Not the actual phone call, but what's called metadata. Who you call, how long you call for, when you did it, and often where you were at the time. And this was quite controversial. They'd suspected that was happening, but of course they found out for sure. And there was quite a backlash just off that. The next day were details of the prison program, which of course we also, Nick Hopkins revealed that GCHQ was accessing that as well. And this seems to be some program involving getting data out of nine of the sort of biggest technology brands going, Apple, Google, Facebook. They deny being part of any voluntary program, but the existence of this program, PRISM, has been confirmed. What's not quite sure is what the exact scale of it is, exactly how it operates, but it's clear that this is a real thing and there's some relatively large-scale data collection going on. There is also then sort of further stuff looking at how much the NSA is collecting overall. And essentially, it's collecting 97 billion pieces of information over a 30-day period on intelligence operations from computers and about another 100 billion from phones. So this is vast. It's an absolutely huge scale of data collection going on. And we know GCHQ is tied into at least some of it.
Julian, so we know that it's big in terms of data, in terms of numbers, but do we think it's also going to be a really big deal diplomatically, or is it one of these things that's going to sort of blow over quite quickly?
Well, diplomatically, there are already countries in the EU have asked the US, what have you been looking at of our citizens? So in a way, diplomatic repercussions of this can be far-reaching and can go on a long time because so much of the world's internet traffic goes through the US. That gives the US a privileged position in terms of looking at it, and that raises concern, especially in the EU, which tends to be more privacy-minded. So those are diplomatic repercussions. They're also very deep political repercussions in the US.
Mike, your role on these programs, I hope you won't mind me saying, is quite often to calm us all down. This is a big deal, big data, and all the rest of it. But could we turn it round and say it's a story of intelligence agency shock horror gathering intelligence on people?
It took me two or three days to sort of get a handle on all this in my own head. And I'm, to be honest, still not quite clear of the scale or significance without dissenting from what everybody said. I was genuinely surprised, and I don't often say that, listening to William Hague in the Commons on, I think it was Monday, telling MPs was all fine and dandy, and most of them queuing up to agree with him. Interestingly, there were several dissidents, all parties. I'm glad to say David Blunkett was one, David Davis, the Tory libertarian, former Shadow Home Secretary on the other. Blunkett said, we're not suggesting, for example, this is one of many aspects of it, that the GCHQ, which is our equivalent of the NSA at Fort Meade in Maryland, just between Baltimore and Washington, that GCHQ doesn't ask the Americans for stuff about Brits, but what if it was offered? And you don't really get an answer on that. And it was noticeable from Hague's answers that he was being quite careful in what he said. He managed not to mention the word prism once, I think. So you're troubled by it, but in fairness, you're also troubled by aspects of the other side, because Glenn Greenwald's claim to, you know, the NSA has direct access, that was the famous phrase, has been kicked around quite a lot. I'd be interested to hear what James says about this by other people who know their stuff, who say it's more of a Dropbox. That's the phrase the Guardian's Charles Arthur and Dominic Rush used in a piece of this kind, where you sort of drop stuff in when it's so big you can't send it by email. People are listening are familiar with Dropboxes, and that's not the same as direct access. And in any case, they say, why hasn't Greenwald given an interview to technical specialists, or why hasn't Philip Snowden, people who really know this stuff as well as they do, probably better? So, you know, I'm still 10% skeptical. It's a big story and it raises big questions, and all the experts are now saying, golly gosh, isn't it great to discuss it in public? We can sort it out. Security and liberty, the old dilemma. But they weren't saying that a week ago.
I think it's quite significant to look at a couple of bits of this. I think it's been a week that's been a sort of masterwork study in carefully worded denials and carefully phrased public statements. And so when is direct access direct access? The sense, you know, a lot of the reporting seems to suggest that it's direct in the sense that as far as the analyst is concerned, he or she just types into their computer sort of what they want, and they don't have to speak to anyone, they don't have to go in front of a court, they get it. Now, whether that's because of a sort of semi-automated process involving Dropboxes or an actual direct tap to the server has been made a matter of big significance. I think one of the things, we actually released some extra information from the slides, which was saying sort of this direct access idea was being used to contrast with the idea of, say, cable intercepts or that kind of thing. And so it's one of these things where people are hinging words in different ways. To sort of briefly step in for Glenn, and, you know, full disclosure, I did some additional reporting on this story, so it's, you know, feel the need to defend it. But I think it's quite difficult to talk about, you know, well, why isn't Glenn talking about technical details or operational details of this kind of story, when obviously part of the way you publish this kind of thing responsibly with sensitive material is not to go into too much detail. Because, you know, while, you know, as Edward Snowden himself said, he could have just published all of this directly and he'd have brought down the surveillance system in a day, as he says it. As it is, he's trying to have a sort of, it seems like he's trying to have a more responsible public debate. And actually, it's kind of been quite successful. We're talking about privacy and security a lot more than we're talking about, was this leak grossly irresponsible?
Mike, do you think it sounds like some of these distinctions James is making here between, direct access via a Dropbox or not? You know, these are the kind of things that many of us, and certainly most people in the House of Commons, for that matter, United States Congress, won't be familiar with. And they've written rules that are already a bit out of date, I imagine, on a lot of this stuff. Isn't it one of those cases where the technology has just overtaken such law as an oversight as there is?
Yes, that happens all the time. And we in journalism were involved in rapidly evolving technologies, struggling to keep up with the new media in all sorts of ways. You know, people like me who are raised in old-fashioned print journalism, I mean, it sounds like pre-Caxton, pre-Gutenberg, compared with 20 years years ago, I'm astonished by the things I can do sitting at my kitchen table. So, we're racing to catch up, and most of us are pretty hopeless, and we should admit it. That's why I was careful to say, you know, the technical community are having a debate about this, and there are arguments on both sides, as there are among the politicians. Congressman Pete King, who was a great apologist for IRA bombers on the run many years ago from New York, like they do, he's very keen to have everybody extradited and shot. Glenn Greenwald included. I must say that one of the good things about this, as a sort of consumer of media and obviously wanting The Guardian to score a lot of goals, is that Edward Snowden sounds a very mature, grounded, sensible young man. And, you know, I name no names, Julian Assange, but, you know, Assange is a curious fellow, and Snowden sounds pretty normal to me. And even when the newspapers publish photographs of his pretty girlfriend in order to make him out to be some sort of eccentric, you think, no, you're getting that wrong. They just make him sound more normal.
A steady sort of source.
But Julian, very important, the reliability of the witness. You think, you put this man in court, he'd probably be all right. You can't say that about everybody in the whistleblowing world. It's a funny world.
Julian, could you just talk us round how this is playing out in Washington? I mean, it seems, from the little I've read about it, as if it's dividing both parties. It's, you know, in a very polarized political system, it seems like the Republicans in particular are quite split on this. What to make of it, aren't they?
Yeah, it's brought together sort of libertarians from the right and left. And it has split the Senate and Intelligence Committee. And the leadership of the committee was professes itself to be quite happy with the information it was getting. There's some people on the committee, and prominent senators like Mo Udall and Ron Wyden, who believe that they have been misled consistently by the intelligence community. And you had this famous video of James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, when he was asked, but are we collecting data on millions or hundreds of millions of America? And he said, no, sir. And he later, after the emergence of these documents, had to qualify that, saying, well, it was the least dishonest thing I could think of to say. and so there is questions of, because Obama made such an issue of congressional oversight, we're now seeing that the congressmen involved and senators involved actually have a very narrow amount of information, and that information is being passed when it's being given to them by the intelligence community.
So it's kind of it's an awkward one for Obama in terms of consensus politics and all that. But is it not also awkward for him with many of the younger supporters who he had, many of whom were kind of giving small donations on online and using new media to spread the word?
Sure, all those people were elemental in his first and second campaign, that kind of internet groundswell that he had among young people. But of course, he doesn't have to face election again.
If I can interview briefly, there was an article in the Times by Hugo Rifkin in the week who said nobody under 30, over 30, gets this. It's like having somebody in your prefrontals. I mean, the Times, like everybody else, is divided on the importance of the Guardian story, and media is always mean to other people's scoops. That's life. But the idea that the young people get it because they live their lives online in a way that us wrinklies don't is an interesting perspective.
Do you think there's some any evidence about how many people have heard of this story?
So, well, I mean, this is huge in the US. So The Guardian in America has commissioned sort of an official opinion poll, and I've got the results in front of me. 90% of people who responded to this opinion poll, formal one, had heard about the story. This is
unheard of. So this isn't people just replying on the Guardian website who read Guardian stuff?
Oh, no. This is
the public as a whole.
This is real people.
Opinion. This is real people. But as well, it also shows that this is really sort of causing a degree of concern. You know, 56% of people said they were more worried about the civil liberties implications of this than any national security bits of the leak. 48% of respondents said it would make them less likely to vote for Barack Obama if they had the chance to do it again. They support him less. But people are quite critical of really everyone concerned. 56% of people say Congress has not done enough to supervise the activity of American spies. 60% of people want to hear more about what data is being collected so they can come to a judgment. And quite a lot of people want even the role of the NSA to be reviewed.
Can we just talk about the tech companies? I mean, over the last few years, we've had a whole run of bad news stories in terms of trust for, you know, they're talking about Obama and Congress and what oversight there should be, obviously, in the UK. Mike's going to bark about tax. But I was thinking, here we have an issue where the people that, you know, we've talked up, that we've not given the same pressure to as greedy MPs with their expenses, the Googles, the Facebooks and the rest of it, have got big questions to answer. Are we going to start distrusting them as much as we've always been paranoid about government, James?
It's quite difficult. These guys are really, really keen to try and position themselves as, we just do what the government wants, you know, what it has to. We don't do any more. We don't do voluntary stuff. But, you know, they're in a difficult position in that there's things they can't talk about. But people just don't always quite believe them. And it's quite tricky. You know, Microsoft, for example, really unluckily, they're running a massive advertising campaign at the minute saying your privacy is our priority. And then they're listed as the first company to be involved in this prison program.
How can it not be voluntary if they're all getting involved at different dates, as The Guardian reported?
Well, this is the bizarre thing. It appears to be a sort of one arm behind your back kind of voluntary, a sort of, why not make it a lot easier on both of us to comply with data that you'll have to hand over by building these sort of semi-automated systems? You know, it's kind of voluntary in heavy quotation marks. But
and this is where another of the fudges involved comes in, because each of these searches for important terms or searches for particular foreign communications is approved by a court order. And so all these tech companies have been able to say, well, we don't do this unless there's a particular court order. But what we found out in the process of doing and looking into these stories is that some of these court orders could be blanket, one-off court orders approving access for up to a year.
Oh, I see. Right. So that's not quite the can we listen to this one phone call type of surveillance. Mike, when back in Britain, we know it seems like, I mean, who knows through all William Hague's non-denial denials, but it seems like one of the big issues has been that because the Americans dump a load of stuff on the British authorities, that means that the Britons never asked for it, and so they never needed to ask permission to get it. That sort of sneaky workaround seems to be what's going on. So do you think here it's going to be another question of crisis of trust in the government, or do you think it's going to be more of the techies who get it in the neck?
Well, political culture is very different here than in the States. And James was saying about the sort of left-right thing. A lot of people on the political right, Tea Party people, if you like, in the United States, hate the government. You know, Ronald Reagan used to say the most terrifying sentence in the English language is, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. Ha, ha, ha. He got huge public support for that. So there is a hostility to government in the US, which is quite different from almost anything in Europe, or indeed Canada, for that matter, next door. So it's that's very different. And there's a danger, you know, where you get some awfully funny bedfellows on a story like this. It's quite different in Britain, where we've lived with the trade-offs between liberty and security for a long time. For example, I noticed on some US websites, people are saying, well, you know, London's full of CCTV cameras. We don't put up with them in this country. It is true. They resist them much more strongly. So we start very much from a different place. I think we agree that there's wriggle room in what Hague said, and that ministers are always happy to take the line from the security community. We have a much better oversight system, the Intelligence and Security Committee, than we had up to 20 years ago in the existence of MI5 and MI6, let alone that large building in Cheltenham, were more or less denied. I mean, it was absurd until well within my adult lifetime. But even so, you always feel that the ISC committee members, they're both peers and MPs, their chairman is Malcolm Rifkin, a former Foreign and Defense Secretary. By coincidence, they're in Washington today. They're all vetted. They're all what you might call trustees of the system. And, you know, we hope they're skeptical. We're not quite sure. The Guardian this week carried an article by David Omand, who's a former spymaster at the Home Office and Intelligence Joint Intelligence Committee, who was, I thought, pretty complacent. And I was pleased to see the paper carried a critique of that by Paddy Ashdown, who is better informed informed, given his background. A spy and a diplomat, sorry, not a spy, a soldier and a diplomat, better informed than most. Whoops, Paddy, criticizing that today. And that's what we want. We want a healthy debate. But they weren't volunteering it a week ago. And as James, I think, said, Obama has a disappointing record as president, being a critic of the overmighty and intrusive state than he had as a candidate.
Okay. Well, there's going to be plenty more on this story, I'm sure, on our website. And you can watch the full-length interview with whistleblower Edward Snowden at guardian.co.uk/US. But as pupils across the country look ahead to their summer holiday, the GCSE courses that they've just completed have once again come under attack as too soft. But this time it's from the Education Secretary, Michael Gove. The exams that they've just sat, he says, lack public confidence, rely too much on dubious coursework and are nowhere near rigorous enough. Mike, so in the end, Michael Gove was going to keep the GCSE name, change the grading system, toughen up the curriculum, more weight on those final written exams. Is he on the right track, or is this just more Govean nostalgia?
Well, I'm very conflicted on this, apart from the fact that I haven't sat any exam whatsoever since 1966. And I'll tell you why I'm conflicted. I could whiz through exams as a child and as a student. The only exam I ever failed was A-level Latin. I was so confident that I went to the pub the night before the free translation. I learned many years later that Simon Hoggett made the same mistake. We both failed it. There, I've got it out in the open. But the only exam I ever failed, and two of my children are like that, whereas my wife never passed an exam in her life, and she's a really smart woman. And the third of our sons is like her. And I know what it's like, having seen it at close hand, to be dyslexic. You get into the exam room and you panic. And a lot of people are like this. Many of them are very smart, as we know. Perhaps that young man, Edward Snowden, we were talking about a moment ago, he failed. He flunked school and he flunked college, but he's obviously a very bright young man. So I sympathize with the movement of the last 30 years, which widened the old GCE, which I took, into the GCSE, which was more inclusive. But at the same time, my sort of exam whiz brain says, all this coursework sounds a bit soft and suspicious to me, and it can be abused. Well,
so
all systems can be abused. Well, we do know, because you can resit modules and things like that. My children going through the school system, you saw things which made your hair stand on end. So part of my brain is sympathetic to Gove trying to tighten things up a bit, and part of it says, no, you're losing something of value to the wider community, people who don't pass exams as easily as I do. It's very, very difficult.
James,
and I was glad to see, last point, that he seemed to have been forced into a more consensual position by the reaction and resistance to his more ambitious, Govish, slightly silly ideas, by the usual suspects, by teachers and professors and official demand by parents.
So he's backed off a bit. But James, what do you think? I mean, it sounds to me a bit odd to have more emphasis on recall in a room on your own, in a world where everyone's got Encyclopedia Britannica in their pocket in the form of a mobile phone. And so,
well, it's a completely artificial challenge. Yes, we face in sort of adult life moments of high stress and high tension where you've got to deliver. That's like an exam, but usually you have every resource to draw on. What we need to teach people these days is how to synthesize information, is how to understand it, is things like numerical literacy, computer literacy, statistics are getting more and more important. And actually, the new curricula, as they're currently suggested, don't include it. You have a lot of really quite silly measures in this, sort of changing lettered grades to numbered grades, but the same number. You know, instead of eight letters, you have eight numbers. If that's
then
not
go the other way down,
Titanic, what is?
It's like changing the logo. It just freshens things up.
And so, essentially, you know, I think the core of this is there's very little basis. There's no evidence suggesting that studying to exams is any better than trying to study skills and coursework and so on. And frankly, is it not better to give people a challenge which represents what they'll have to do, what they'll need for employers, what they'll need for study, than artificially teaching to tests? My niece is taking her GCSEs right now. She is a very bright student, very conscientious student. She has awful exam anxiety. I mean, you know, and you do see differences. Boys, because they're more confident generally, do better on exams.
Oh, really?
Girls do better on coursework. There is an evidence.
Relatively,
split.
You mean?
Relatively.
Because girls are doing better on
overall,
everything.
Overall, girls get far better grades, and that gap is widening. This may close it a little, but it just seems as if it's done. The whole philosophy underlying everything seems to be education was brilliant in private schools about 25 years ago. That's the system. That's the one true way.
But there's another oddity here, isn't there, Mike, in terms of the Gove mission? Because it was all about free schools, setting schools free to be an island of educational autonomy with their own tie and their own song. And now here's Michael Gove sitting like the man in the French ministry saying, no, you're going to read The Tempest all the way through, otherwise you're not leaving the classroom.
Well, there's always a paradox in the rhetoric of liberty. Mrs. Thatcher years ago was always centralising things in order to set them free. Eric Pickles' localism act of a couple of years ago, God, you listen to him introducing it, it was very dictatorial. And Gove is finding himself in the same spot. They always do, because they're concerned about standards, and they think if you allow what in the health context we call the postcode lottery, letting people go their own way, in a small country like this, it's not so true. In a huge country like the US, you know, what they do in Somerset is noticed by the people in Devon. We already see it in healthcare in Britain, and with the exam systems, we're going to see it in Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland. Scotland already separate, of course. That creates anxiety. Personally, you know, I think if you opt for localism, then you ought to stick by it and take the consequences. But the consequences will include, you know, unfair results, and as a report said only last week, more people from London and the South East getting into Oxbridge than from other parts of the country. That's the trouble. Localism is inherently unfair.
And James, how do you think this leaves Michael Gove some stock? He's a sort of interesting figure zigzagging around from being the outrider for Cameron compassion to the first bloke saying we need to get out of the EU.
I think Michael Gove does best when he's talking about anything except education, really. It's it's quite hard to find really ardent supporters. It's you know, he does very well, plays very well with the Conservatives to do. I'm taking on the teaching unions, and that's all you ever hear. You would think the unions were still some ultra powerful monolith. Any move in education, you just hear, this is what the teachers' unions don't want.
They are quite like noisy in education.
Oh, yes, they are. But are they the relevant factor? Is it taking on the unions? Or is this right for students? Is this right for parents? Is this right for employers? And I just don't think he's actually convinced on any of those three answers. So he's just saying, hey, the teachers hate it. And as if that's the win.
And Mike, do you see him kind of going further? I mean, either into being Home Secretary or something, or even beyond that to number 10 at some point?
No, I don't think he's number 10 material, and I don't think he thinks it either. Let's face it, Tom, he's a fellow hack. He's just a jumped-up journalist like us. He's a very nice and courteous fellow. He was very, in the House of Commons this week, he was so polite to the MPs. When Diane Abbott, interesting, a black member of parliament, says, we need rigorous standards. That's the only chance for clever poor children to get on. And he said, yes, oh gosh, I'd have voted for you as Labour leader. Typical Gove. He's an interesting figure because I knew him in a previous life. I find it slightly difficult to take him too seriously. I don't think he's a deep thinker, but he is a firebrand, and he has an interesting ideas and an interesting background. Don't forget, he's an adopted child from Scotland of quite a modest background who has got where he's got. And he thinks that clever kids like him will do what he does manage to do with his recipe. I don't think James and I are convinced he's right, but he's not a crook. He's not just there. He's trying to do good. He's not a cynic.
Well, on that very fair note, we'll draw things to a close. As always, you can leave your thoughts on our blog and find us on SoundCloud. My thanks to Julian Borgia, to Michael White and to James Ball. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.